Welcome to In the Studio with the 21st Century Perspective on History's Greatest Rock Albums.
Excuse me.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
guitar three.
I'm Red Beard, and today in the studio, it's the anniversary of the breakthrough U.S. album for the Cops of Rock.
Well, there's only three of us. No room for passengers when there's only three of you. There certainly were no restrictions. In fact, quite the reverse. The fewer musicians there are on stage, the freer each of the musicians are.
Sound of the Police, the arrangements, the sound between the guitar, bass and drums is a synthesis of many different musics. You know, what was great for me to find out as I got to know Sting, that hey, this guy's not just some rock bass player. He's had a jazz fusion career. He knows all this other stuff. He knows about Jaco Pastorius. Then I found out that, you know, he's really into classical guitar, and I played classical guitar for years. And, you know, there was a big musical background that went just beyond, you know, pop songs of the day.
Hi, this is Stuart Copeland in the studio for Zenyatta Mandata by The Police.
In the studio, and I'm Sting with Redbeard, and he still has it.
Buddy Holly and the Crickets, Bill Haley and the Comets, Johnny Burnett's rock and roll trio. These seminal bands defined the three-piece format in the beginning of rock and roll. Cream made the power trio a rock and roll icon that we've all venerated and still do to this day. Bands like the Kinks and the Who simply put a non-playing singer out in front of the three-piece rock and roll trio format, kind of like a non-running quarterback in the West Coast offense in football. And punk rockers like the Ramones and the Sex Pistols, they kept the exact same format, just turning it up to 11 and doubling or tripling the tempo and the attitude. But what's really fascinating is that this same basic three-piece format that we think is so synonymous with rock and roll is equally the basis for the jazz combo lineup as well. Keep that in mind a little later on in the show. Founded by American drummer Stuart Copeland, bass-playing singer-songwriter Sting, and their second guitar player, the only veteran among them, Andy Summers, when the band The Police played songs from their first two albums in increasingly larger halls in the spring of 1980, there was little consideration to their three-piece lineup sounding just like the two previous released albums, according to drummer Stuart Copeland.
There certainly were no restrictions. In fact, quite the reverse. The fewer musicians there are on stage, the freer each of the musicians are. You have to do more. You have to lay it down more. But also, harmonically and rhythmically, there's more space that you have to experiment in. For instance, if we had added a keyboard player, Andy would never have been able to play half the chords he played because he would have had to check with the keyboard player first, and they would have had to rehearse these things, because with two harmonic instruments going, they've got to be in sync. They've got to kind of plan it out. It's like a brass section. You have to write the parts out for them, or you can't just have four guys jamming up there. They have to know that I'm going to play the root of the chord, you're going to play the third, and so on. So in other words, without that, with only one harmonic instrument, one rhythm instrument, and then the bass, we were each able to, I could go off into weird tangents on my own without, like, if I'd had a percussionist, I would have had to stay locked in with him or something like that. But because I'm all the percussion we got, I had to keep busy, and it made me have to stretch. It stretched us out. And also, the fact that we didn't have other musicians to leave space for meant that we were really free to get right out there. We, with a three-piece in improvisation, and, you know, when you jam with a three-piece, you really can go further out there into the outer cosmos and keep together than you can with a four- or five-piece. With a four- or five-piece, it tends to be the band holds a groove while one of them takes a solo. In a three-piece, all three of you can just spread out.
Young teacher, the subject of schoolgirl fantasy. She wants him so badly, knows what she wants to be. Inside her, there's longing, this girl's an open.
page, bookmarking. She's so close now. This girl is half his age.
That's The Police from 1980's Zenyatta Bandana album with Don't Stand So Close to Me, which would be another in a string of number one hits for The Police in the UK and peak at number 10 in the United States in April 1981. On the song's intro, you can actually hear guitars tuning up, chords crackling, voices talking back to the recording engineer in the control room. Drummer Stuart Copeland explains why.
You're waiting for the countdown to begin, and you got your cans on, you got your instrument in your hand, you're waiting for the countdown, and you're kind of noodling around, and you're not even, you know, you can hear that the tape started to roll because you hear the hiss kick in, but you're still kind of waiting for the count in, and you noodle. Like the beginning of Don't Stand So Close to Me is a full virtuoso noodle concerto. And you eventually, by the time you've finished all your overdubs, you've got this whole tapestry of pre-tune noodling. And a lot like in Roxanne, the famous Sting's laugh at the front of Roxanne. Was just he was waiting for the track to begin. He sat down on the piano. The lid wasn't down, so he sat on the keys and went boop like that, and he laughed. You know, you can just barely hear the piano, and you can hear him laughing. And then the counting comes, and he sings the song. We all thought this was so amusing and so real. It was also, it seemed like realistic to us instead of having this pristine track, so there's silence and then the track. So we left in all the warts and everything. And that's what it is. That was a wart.
What is my reaction? that when some innocent die, all we can offer them is a page in some magazine. Too many cameras and not enough food. This is what we've seen. Driven to tears. Driven to tears. Driven to tears.
Third album, Zenyatta Mandata, The Police, with, quote, Sting's first set of politically charged lyrics, which observe the declining state of the world, says writer Greg Prado on AllMusic.com. Police guitarist Andy Summers has had a solo instrumental career for over 20 years in between stints with The Police. I sat down with Andy Summers in the studio on the 35th anniversary of Zenyatta Mandata.
You've worked with one of the greatest bands in modern history, and now you've been trekking through the wonderful body of work on your own. What are the pros and cons of each, and what do you miss about a band, and what don't you?
Well, that's a really interesting question.
And a long one, and I apologize.
A long one. There's a couple of good answers to it. Yeah, you know, being in a band like The Police, of course, one of the things that makes the band is all the confrontation, all the spark, all the chemistry that has to somehow come together and make a thing, you know. But, you know, my sort of stock response to that is it's sort of what you want, because you want that kind of sparky chemistry. I mean, if you've got three really mellow guys, it ain't going to work. I think all the really great rock bands are sort of marked by that kind of, you know, that sort of chemistry that really, you know, you have to kind of
squeezing out sparks.
Yeah, no, I say the music of The Police is the sound of tight compromise, you know, and that's what we get to. And that's what, you know, somehow translates to an audience, I think, that there are three egos, or however many, battling it out on stage and making this exciting music. So I suppose, you know, if once you abandon that, you know, and you go to be like the, in quotes, solo artist, and basically you end up sort of paying for other people's services, they're mostly going to say yeah.
To record their third album, The Police went to Holland to save money on taxes, according to drummer Stuart Copeland.
At that point, we'd had the first album, had started to create a buzz. The second album actually had a few hits on it. And this third album was supposed to be the breakthrough. And we had the record company in the studio with us saying, come on, guys, we're going for the big one now. This is where the pressure's really on now. The first two are the setup, and this is your home run, guys. You're on third base now. You know, bases are loaded. You know, and that was the album where we actually really felt the pressure, and it affected the album to a certain extent. There's some of my favorite cuts on it, but there was that atmosphere, and it was after that, okay, we got our home run. Then we could take it easy. We went down to Montserrat, which was halfway around the world. 12-hour flight from the nearest record company, and we were able to relax, and we kind of got over that hump. But that album was a tense session.
Interesting construction there. The song never changes key. The verses are identical to the chorus. It's one continuous repeating figure for 3.5 minutes. Nothing could be more simple, and yet it's totally effective from the Police. Andy Summers, Sting, and Stuart Copeland will return to explain why the singer always gets the final say. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the 5th anniversary of Zenyatta Mandata by The Police.
In the studio with The Police, I'm Stuart Copeland with Redbeard.
Welcome back. In the studio, and I'm Sting with Redbeard, and he still has it.
Thank you, guys. In two separate interviews, both drummer Stuart Copeland and guitarist Andy Summers each stated that the singer must have the final say on the basics of a song's key, tempo, etc. Here is policeman Andy Summers. When Stuart discovered Sting singing in the tiny university hall, Sting was playing jazz, not rock, not pop, or even punk.
Mm-hmm.
How did your jazz chops and your interest in jazz figure into establishing a musical dialogue with Sting in this new band that you were joining?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because I think one of the things that does, you know, characterize the music of The Police is that, you know, yeah, in a very general sense, we're playing rock. it's pop music. It's vocals, you know, it's verse, chorus. But the sound of the Police, the arrangements, the sound between the guitar, bass, and drums is a sort of a synthesis of many different musics, you know. What was great for me to find out as I got to know Sting, that, hey, wait a minute, this guy's not just some rock bass player. He's had a jazz fusion group. He knows all this other stuff. He knows about Jaco Pastorius. Then I found out that, you know, he's really into classical guitar, and I'd played classical guitar for years. And so, you know, and you know about, he knew a lot of old stuff. There was a big musical background that went just beyond, you know, pop songs of the day. He was drawing on a big bag, you know, and so was I by that point. We both had a lot of music, you know, that was not just rock and pop, but was also jazz and classical and Brazilian music, interest in Indian music. So once we started to really get into it, we had a lot of references together. But we still had the plan to be a rock band, but we were able to bring some more interesting ingredients into it than maybe some other groups could.
Canary in a Coal Mine comes from the Police third album, Zenyatta Mandata. In an earlier interview, Sting had remarked, while almost thinking out loud, what it would take to write a hit in America. And lo and behold, it seems that with Zenyatta, he consciously set out to do just that.
See, those sort of considerations have always been outside the band. The most we can do is to follow our own path and to play music that we feel right. Because if you go on stage or you try and make records that aren't really the way you feel about music, there is always a false note there, and eventually it translates to an audience. And ironically, it loses its commerciality for that very same reason. In our case, we've never had to compromise ourselves musically. We've done what we felt right. Sting is a great songwriter, and he's written some very commercial songs, but he never set out to write commercial songs. That's the way they've come out and the way we've played them, and it's turned out to be a commercial success, not only down to the music as well, but also as well to our timing and to the image of the band and a combination of things. But the main thing for us is to be free musically and not to have to adhere to successful formulas that we may have unwittingly created in the past. We want to go on enjoying it, you know, and to start having to slaver to record company policies or commercial formulas is not the way I want to live my life.
I think we're talking hypothetically here, and I think the Police will eventually make it big in America. I'm very confident of it because we're so determined to do it. However, if we take this hypothesis further, say that there is going to be the schism between British rock and what's big there in American rock, then as a songwriter and a performer, I'd be interested purely from an experimental point of view to change our music to see what would be a hit. It interests me as a songwriter to find out what people get off on. I could actually do it. I could compromise our music to such an extent that it might be a hit in America. I could see ways of doing it. But the fact is we don't. The fact is we want to stay as we are, and we'll do it in our own, on our own terms.
The Beat Cop, Stuart Copeland of The Police.
Sting has a very high regard for the songwriting talent. To write a song that appeals to everybody is a very high calling for him. I mean, I would always tease him, and this is something that we would get into fights about. When I wanted to irritate him, I'd say, look, you're just writing pop songs. For him, songs are very important, and it's a very high art form for him. And to be able to write a song that every painter and decorator will be able to whistle as he's putting up wallpaper, that's something that's important and that he regards highly as something to do. It's not a question. He wasn't thinking, what would it take to make me lots of money to have a hit
He
was thinking, what would it take to actually make a song that this entire country could respond to?
Exactly. That would be undeniable.
Yeah. And that's something that the song is very important to him. I mean, that his bass playing kind of began to take second place, even his singing, to writing the song. And that's what, I suppose that you got to have that value system to be a songwriter like that. Well, he was never satisfied, and I don't think, until he wrote Every Breath You Take. That, for him, was what he meant. And quite a few years passed between that conversation that you had with him and writing Every Breath You Take. It's easily misunderstood as well.
That is totally complimentary.
Yeah, I mean, it might seem that he's chasing the commercial thing, but that really wasn't the commercial thing. He wanted to write a song that speaks to everyone, and it really is a high art form. It's actually, I found this with Animal Logic. In fact, I've learned this over my long career, that it's, people talk about selling out. Well, in fact, I tell you what, we're starving. Let's sell out and write a pop song and make lots of money, shall we? Yeah, let's do that. It's not quite as easy as that, folks. It's not that easy to write to sell out. I mean, because there's not that many buyers, and there actually is an art form. Even the groups that you hate, I don't know if Barry Manilow writes his songs, but those songs, those common denominator songs do take a lot of talent to create those songs. I might not want to buy them myself, or may not respond because I'm a musician with snobby musical attitudes, and as a musician, I've got fairly esoteric tastes. But it is a higher calling to be able to write within 2.5 minutes something that speaks to everyone. And you can call it common denominator if you like, but I think that's kind of a negative way of putting it. It's kind of, to find a common language is something to find, Then the job of the musicians is to make it interesting. So Sting was trying to write this common denominator song, and at the same time, as a musician, as a player, we would all think of ways of screwing it up.
Don't think me, I'm
The police song with the nonsensical title actually was the first number one hit for them in the U.S., driving the album Zenyatta Mandata to number one in the U.K. and number three Billboard album chart here. Here's Sting with me in the studio talking about the artistic payoff of writing a hit song.
It's a nice feeling. It's a very confirming feeling, you know. I did a Saturday Night Live with Dana Carvey, and I'm standing in an elevator. I'm playing myself, you know. He gets in and starts to sing Roxanne. And, you know,
in a suit. Yeah.
In a suit. And this, this is not a sketch. This is my life. People do this all the time. They sing to me. And I think that's wonderful for a popular songwriter to have reached a lot of people unconsciously. It's something I wrote in the living room, you know, with a dog at my feet, you know, and just to amuse myself. Is now a song on that people can dredge from their memories and bring up. You know, it's there. It's in people's psyches. And I think that's great. I'm very privileged to be a songwriter. It's a great feeling. Don't let anybody tell you different.
Next, Andy Summers, Sting, and Stuart Copeland return to talk about how the Police shared a lot more in common with Miles and Mingus than Johnny Rotten. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with the Police for the anniversary of Zenyatta Mandata.
Welcome back. In the studio with the Police. I'm Stuart Copeland with Redbeard.
In the studio, and I'm Sting with Redbeard, and he still has it.
The first Police album in late 1978, Outlandos D'Amour, had contained the hit Roxanne, and mostly because of their album cover, the Police got lumped in with the punk rock movement. But they had dyed their hair to make a few bucks for a TV commercial in London. The music never was punk rock, really, and their brilliant second album, 1979's Regatta de Blanc, solidified that fact. Regatta's atmospheric layers would, it seems, present a dilemma, though, for a three-piece band live. Here's Stuart Copeland of The Police.
Well, to recreate the album is a question that many groups face. And The Police, we never faced this. We would make our record, we would do any amount of overdubs and studio stuff to make the record work.
With no regard?
We no regard for how we would pull it off on stage at all. We never, you know, we knew that all we had to go out and do it and give us, you know, we didn't even need to play the song. We'll just go out there and, you know, as long as someone remembers the lyrics more or less and gets the chorus right, that'll do. And so we never worried about that. And as I explained, when we get out there, we'd take the basic skeleton of the song and do whatever happened on the night. And there was a lot of variety from night to night as well. We would throw each other curve balls just to keep it live. But in the studio, we would do everything. We would he would even double track the bass. I would overdub drums. The guitars would take up three slave reels of different guitar sounds. He would have a different guitar sound for each chorus and double it and layer it and have the stereo version. And then the solo, he'd spend a day on, you know. We'd use the studio for every trick it had to make the record sound good. Never worry for a moment about what we would do once we got on stage.
Tonight, oh, we got
On the third Police album, Zenyatta Bandata, that's the trio ripping through Driven to Tears on the massive 2007-2008 Police reunion tour, the third highest-grossing concert effort in history. In spite of a long solo career doing instrumentals between stints with the Police, guitarist Andy Summers clearly respects and appreciates the role of each musician in the Cop Collective.
I mean, I personally don't think they sing roles. I think they're guitarist roles. So, not in my mind. You've got to let them think they roll. Yeah, well, anyway, again, we go back. This is the hallmark of a great band. There's a lot of undercurrent. And let's put it in this way. You know, musically, you've got to serve the vocal. If you're doing rock music or any kind of music that's vocal, you've got to serve the vocal because that's what people, that's the lead line. People are hearing that. So, I don't necessarily think the singer rules creatively, but I think, you know, we're all in the position, you know, in vocal music of serving the voice. creatively.
Voices inside my head echoes things that you say. Voices
best of what's around. When the world is running down, you make the best of what's still around. When the world is running down, you make the best of what's still around. Yeah.
The Police on the anniversary of Zenyatta Mondatta. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Stuart Copeland, Sting, and Andy Summers. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net.